foot. So the distributed capacitance, I think, worked out, I don't remember, somewhere in the neighborhood of, 210 picofarad or something like that. So I worked it out that way so that needed, an additional, the variable capacitor would require like another 100 PF to resonate the loop, Dick. So that's about the only things I remember about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm doing a quick calculation right now. Okay, sure enough, those number of picofarad is very close to resonance. Your Q, if you can tune plus or minus 15 kilohertz, is a Q of around 200. So it is a high Q by normal antenna characteristics. An 80-meter dipole is nowhere near that narrow band. But let's face it, this antenna is a tenth of a wavelength in circumference. So to be that small as an H-field sensing device,
turns is the antenna.
It's one turn of coax cable, if I understand correctly. In other words, you've made a 3 foot by 3 foot loop of coax cable. I'm guessing you brought the loop back on itself and then put a slot somewhere in the shield that represents the feeding mechanism. Is that approximately what you did, Mel? Go ahead.
If anyone's interested looking at it, I'm just looking. I got that. Just in fact, I just pulled out the one of the antenna books. It seems to be in a number of them. This happens to be what, the 18th edition of the ARRL antenna book, and it's called A Receiving Loop for 1.8 megahertz, except the one I built it for 80 meters, so you just chop everything in half, basically, approximately. It's a little bit, the original one that they show is 20 feet in square. Mine is 12 feet square. I don't remember how I worked it all out to come out with that, but picture a piece of RG-59. Let me let it drop. I'll describe it, because you don't have the book, you know. Otherwise, I could say a picture worth a thousand words. Hold on. There. Okay. Piece of RG-59, and let's say you make the square, you make the this rectangle 12 feet. And now, if you look at it, let's say we sit it like looking at it as a baseball diamond. The bottom point is the start point. We stretch the piece of coax around. When we get to it, would be second base. We just put the shield, you know, we put a cut in so the shield is separated by, called a split shield. Then we continue around, we go back down to the base, and we put across the two center turns of the coax, we put the variable capacitor, and then from one of the turns, one side of the one part of the loop, we put that to the feed point, and the outer shield, whatever, you know, shields that we have, we connect all the shields together to the feeder and everything, you know. So in other words, the variable capacitor is actually going between the two points of the center point, and one side of it is connected to the center of the feeder. Over.
Okay, you talked about two turns, and it's a little bit confusing. Could I do this? Your square is 3 foot on a side, and you keep talking about a 12-foot square. You mean 12-foot circumference. So 3 foot on a side, four sides, you've got a 12-foot circumference. If I took 12-foot length of RG-59, ran it from home plate to first base, to second base, to third base, and back to home plate, and if then I cut a slot in the outer shield of that coax cable at second base, and now I've got, coming back from third base toward home plate, I've got center conductor and shield of that cable, and I'm about to do something there. How did I take center conductor and shield of the piece of coax that came from third base back to home? What did I do there? And did I put any kind of a tuning arrangement across the slot at second base? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Just mentioned another way it could be done. There's, I guess you could do it several different ways. One suggestion was to do is just take the square, make a square, like say 3 foot on a side, so it's 12 feet, like you say, in total circumference around the square. At the bottom of the frame, let's say we're using that as a picture frame, at the bottom of the picture frame, we could say we could put the variable capacitor right there in the center of the bottom of the picture frame, then run the wire around, and at the opposite side, right opposite it, you could split the cable there, and then continue on and come back. And at the bottom of the picture frame, you could put the variable capacitor. In other words, one side of variable capacitor will go to one of the coax sensors, and the other side of variable capacitor goes to the other. Remember, the coax is coming back together at the bottom. So you're just putting, in other words, you're putting the variable capacitor right across the center of the coax at the bottom where you stretch the wire around. And then you just take one side of the variable capacitor and you put that to the feeder. That's the center of your RG59 feeder cable. And all the shields just connect together, over.
Yeah, you gave us a lot of ambiguity there, Mel. There's an awful lot taking place at home plate. You haven't told me what I did with the shield of the piece of coax transmission line that went to the receiver. I've got a piece of RG59 coming from the receiver. It first comes up to home plate. And let's assume that I've stripped away a little of the outer rubber so I can make contact to the shield at that point if I want to. I've continued with that piece of RG59 with one single circumference. I went to first base, second base, third base, and I brought it back to home plate. In one of the embodiments, I've got a slot cut in the shield at second base. Now when I come back to home plate, I've got three or four things I can contact. I've got an outer shield coming back from third base toward home plate. I've got a center conductor of that coax cable coming back from third base toward home plate. I've got the stripped rubber away from the outer shield of the transmission line coming straight up from the receiver to home plate. And maybe if I make the right kind of a cut, I've also got access to the center conductor of the transmission line at home plate. So I've got potentially three or four contact points at home plate. I've got a capacitor, a variable capacitor between some combination of those that hasn't yet been described to me. And I maybe do or don't have a slot up at second base. So go slow and describe what I do with the four wires of your particular antenna right now, the one that's got the slot at second base. What did you do with the three or four contact points and the variable capacitor at home plate? Go slow.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Go slow. Make believe that we are sight-impaired people, and you're going to mentally, with words, describe this picture to us, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
You don't happen to have one of the ARRL antenna handbooks, Dick, because there seems to be, I looked in a few of them, looked in the 19th edition, 17th, seems to be the same thing as described. Any of them available by you?
Yes, they are. They're in the other end of the house. I'm going to carry the handy-talkie with me. I'll listen to what you say. Give me 60 seconds to come back with that thing, and then also tell me what page I'm going to go to. Go ahead, Mel.
C2SYO with a comment. I have the page available.
I have it also in the 18th edition. I'm just holding it. It's on chapter 5, 19, page 19 and page 20. Well, those who don't have it, it's just that the coax comes together. Where the two ends of the coax come together, you're just putting a variable capacitor basically across the two sets of pieces of the coax, tying all the shields together and then taking the feeder and connecting it to one side of the variable capacitor. I don't know if I could explain it any simpler. I think Dick most likely will put it in much better words. I don't know how else I can convey it. So let Dick come back, and I'm sure he's going to give a better description than I did.
Question, Bill?
And I have it on page 820 in the 14th edition.
Yeah, I can say it's been in almost all the handbooks, a very popular antenna, and whoever made one up or similar in other arrangements of all say, phenomenal! I heard, you know, how many guys said, that can't work. I said, come over. I'll show it to you. They sit there with their mouth open. I got to make that. Where'd you buy the parts? Well, you know, nothing. I said, everything here you most likely have or you buy at Home Depot, except the piece of cable and the variable.
Question, Mel? I'm looking
at the 17th edition. What chapter number has this loop antenna?
In the 17th, I got the 18th edition. It's chapter 5. Chapter 5? I think it's look in the front, Dick, on the loop antennas. What chapter loop antennas are on?
8-20 in the 14th edition. Chapter 5 is loop antennas. Okay, how many pages in do I look for this particular thing? Is it 5-5?
In mine, it's 5-19. I'm looking at the 18th edition. It says a receiving loop for 1.8. I think it's the end of the chapter, over.
Sure enough, it's got Jean DeMore, W1CKK, picture of her. Receiving loop for 1.8, and now I see it. Oh, wow. So, at home plate, there is a rectangular box. Oh, that wasn't told to us. There's a rectangular box at home plate, and all three coax cables, come together at that point. All shields connect to the outer box. The center conductor of the lead coming from third base back to home plate, center conductor of the lead going from home plate to first base, those two center conductors have a 400 picofarad variable capacitor between them. And the center conductor going to first base connects to the transmission line center conductor. And the shield is broken at second base. That's the whole antenna. Now it makes sense. We never heard the fact that there was a box at home plate where all three coax cables, the shields, screw into the base metal of that coax box. That's why we had trouble getting this picture, Mel. K2KEY for any corrections. K2RAW, is that the way you did it, Mel?
Didn't use a box. When I slapped it together, Dick, I slapped it together, you know, so quick, and you know, I just put a piece of wood on the bottom with a little bracket, and a metal bracket, a piece of iron that I found, a piece of aluminum, you know, in a right angle piece of aluminum. And I mounted, I tied everything together there. I didn't use any connectors. I just soldered all the shields together. I soldered the wires to the variable capacitor. I just haphazardly put it together, and it's still working. I just want to touch it. It works perfect. I never did make up a box over.
Yeah, when you're all the way down at 3.7 megs, a simple sheet of metal is going to give you such a low amount of inductance that whether you put it inside of a box or not doesn't matter. You do that at 432 megs, you'll be into a lot of trouble. John's got a further question. Go ahead, John. KC2 RFN, K2RIW in the group.
Hey, Mel, would it be worthwhile mounting this outside, you think?
You look at the picture, you'll see it standing outside with Gene.
Yep, I see that.
KC2 QAQ.
Glenn recognized. What you're really asking, as I see it, John, is would the wooden side of Doug DeMore's house, with Gene DeMore in it, his XYL, would that wooden slats on the side of his house have significant absorption at 3.75 megs, and I think the answer is no. As you bring that loop antenna inside the house, yes, you're bringing it near the water pipes and the conduit cables, your BX cables and whatever, and you're getting a little bit of effect from that. But other than that, I think she's going to get 90% of the performance inside the house. Merrill is using it inside of his house, and I think he's getting 90% of the performance he would get if he put it outdoors. Yes, he would get a little more performance if he put it at the top of a 40-foot tower. He doesn't have to do that. Go ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I built an antenna to this stick once, a similar philosophy, but not exactly in this configuration. Basically what I did was I took a form, like a wire form, where I could take magnetic wire, and I put like about 10 turns, very, very closely weaved to each other, and just kept on wrapping them around I think it was like about a three foot, each side was 3 foot, you know, in a square configuration. And in the bottom, I took the two ends of the wire, and I attached basically the coax right there, and then put a vacuum variable tuning capacitor and had it on a rotator. So I could basically tune the antenna remotely from inside the house for a short wave receiver, and I could also rotate this thing with a small rotator up, I guess, somewhere like around 25, 30 feet. And wow, what shortwave reception you could get, and just change the voltage on the vacuum variable and get that high Q performance. And it was a real, SWLer's dream. Back to you, Dick.
How well did that work? How low and how high a frequency did you tune it? And when you changed the voltage on the vacuum variable, that changed its capacitance. Was that a servo mechanism? Back to you, Glenn.
The capacitor is one of those vacuum variables. I don't know if you've ever seen them or not. It looks like a glass tube, and you can apply voltage across it with a decoupling coil. And but the decoupling coil is, you put a little one up there. This is all for stage amp. I don't believe I used it as high as 30 megahertz, but I believe the short wave bands up into like around 20 megahertz. There was a couple up there. Certainly it was very good around the 10 megahertz band. And then, of course, there's the international aircraft frequencies that are around like 5 megahertz. So in those areas, it was a solid performer. And just by adjusting the voltage, you could really just watch the S-meter move. And when you got peaking on the S-meter for the noise floor, that's where the correct tuning was. So it was just a matter of listening to background noise or just watching the S-meter. And just that vacuum variable voltage on it, and it was really phenomenal, Dick. What performance?
All the vacuum variables that I've seen, Glenn, have a glass outer seal, two cookie cutters inside that fold inside of each other to make variable capacitance, a bellows mechanism that allows one of the cookie cutters to move, that allows the two cookie cutters to come close together for high capacitance or far apart for low capacitance. At one end there is a threaded shaft, a shaft with threads on it, and a knob, and as you turn the knob mechanically, you are separating the bellows, making the bellows move so that the two cookie cutters go further apart and closer together. These are the vacuum variable capacitors that I have seen. I'm a little bit curious as to how yours, when you just change the DC voltage you send to it, it somehow changes its capacitance. I'm a bit confused by that, if it's really a vacuum variable mechanical thing that I've seen. Over to you, Glenn.
That's the part, Dick. That's exactly it, but with a small complication to it. There's a company that sells, they're basically like a, they make antenna, very high-powered antenna tuners. They've been around a long time. I know Richie N2EO uses them. I've mentioned them on the air a couple of times, and for right now I can't remember the name of the stupid guys. And they sell these things, and they're like, you can buy them like little motorized units. And they're like vacuum sealed, and it's got the little motor and everything built onto it, and you power them up with 28 volts. And basically just by controlling that voltage up to this device with a control voltage, you can actually control the capacitance and use it as like a remote tuning device. You can also buy from them the motorized inductors. And this is like, I guess, the motorized capacitor is, I guess, the best way of explaining it, Dick. And that's all that I used for it. And it was just basically a big wrapped loop of wire. And then I had a rotator just to, tune the broadside of the loop. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think I'm getting the picture now. You put 28 volts into the electronics, consisting of a motor and a balancing sensing circuit. I am guessing there is a multi-turn potentiometer as part of this 28-volt motor circuit. I'm going to call that a servo mechanism. And if you gave the tuning voltage 1 volt, it turned the motor some number of turns in one direction and tuned to, a low capacitance. And if you put 28 volts on it, it wouldn't balance, the circuit wouldn't balance until it turned a whole lot of turns in the other direction. So it was a servo mechanism where you had 28 volts for power and a tuning voltage which zeroed out the electronics, and the motor would turn its shaft, and it thought it was turning nothing but a shaft encoder, which really was a multi-turn potentiometer, until it got balanced, and then it stopped turning the motor in that direction, and that shaft itself was connected to the vacuum variable capacitor. So it's a remotely tunable servo mechanism vacuum variable capacitor. Beautiful circuit. Out of curiosity, how many picofarad, how many dollars? KC2QIQ, is it still available? K2RIW on the TechNet?
Yeah, actually, it was relatively inexpensive. I think I paid like $12 for it in surplus. I mean, they've got the really high voltage ones and the very high power ones that are really for like the big amplifier and the big tuning circuits. But this was, I think, a 360 or like a, it was like a, almost like the equivalent of like a 365 picofarad, like those open tune shaft type devices, because that's what I was trying to replace. So when I called them up and I asked them for something with whatever they had, basically they did have something in the 300, it was, I think, a little bit more, maybe it was 320 picofarads. It was close to a 365, because when I was experimenting with it indoors, I was using one of those air capacitors, the 365 tunables, with the plates where, you rocket back and forth. And when I got a hold of that little vacuum variable device, that thing was awesome. And as I said, I just used it was designed for a 28-volt circuit. I think I was really running it on 24, and it still performed just as well. And, I just had to give it the control voltage, and you could, and as I said, all I had to really do was watch the S meter on the receiver and just tune the voltage on that until all of a sudden, boop, I saw a peak. And you could hear the background noise come up so that you knew you had the high cue point in the right spot. But very, very interesting antennas. And then once you got the high noise, then you could actually rotate it with a rotator to get a broadside, and that would really, give some performance. But it worked a whole lot better outdoors than it did indoors, for sure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very nice. How big was that vacuum variable, remotely tunable servo mechanism thing? Physically, was it a 3-inch cube, so to speak, of electronics plus the vacuum variable? I think you said you had a solenoid coil across it, which resonated, and the coil was your whole antenna pickup on top of the tower, on top of the rotator. So if I understand you correctly, you could rotate this solenoid coil in azimuth. I presume the axis of the solenoid coil was parallel to the ground. So you could tune the frequency. 30 megs, you think, was the highest you used it. I wondered, did you use it all the way down to 3 megacycles? What was the range of frequencies you used to that? What did the antenna look like in diameter and length? How big was this vacuum variable? How many years ago? Do you think it's still available? Tell us anything. That sounds like a beautiful antenna. You ought to write that one up, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, each side on this, it was a square. And basically, when I mounted the piece of PVC up the center of it, because the PVC was like the mast that held it, so that was kind of like wire tied to that. It was like loosely covered to it, but it didn't matter if it slipped a little bit too, because I could always retouch it up with the rotator again. And I wasn't interested in the absolute direction. I was just interested in rotating it so that it would go, it would pick up the right signals. And it was vertically mounted. So in other words, the broad side of the loop, if you looked at it from, you know, from the street level, you saw a square or a triangle, actually, when you were looking at it with the mast running up the center. The little box on the bottom, which I got from, why can't I remember the name of this, the place that, that sold this little device. But the vacuum variable was a very small one. It was maybe only about an inch thick and maybe like an inch and a half long, maybe 2 inches. But it all fit within a box that was maybe about 3 inches by 4 inches by 2.5 inches high. And it had like those the little feed-through capacitors where you could, you know, make your solder connections to the outside world. And, from there I just ran, you know, the coax, you know, soldered right onto the open wire right there. And it was just magnetic wire, and I used, I believe it was 14 gauge, and I just kept on wrapping it. And I think it was about, each side was three feet, and I used about 10 turns, I believe, and that gave me pretty good resonance through most of the short wave bands. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, if I understand you correctly now, I'm seeing a PVC tube acting as the mast coming out of the top of the rotator. The PVC then wires into a PVC tube to the right and to the left. It makes a 90-degree bend between the two tubes, and then a straight piece across the top that made a triangle, and then some number of turns of this magnetic wire on that. It could be a equilateral triangle. Equilateral? Yeah, it could be equilateral. Or it could be a 90-degree triangle. Could be a 90-degree triangle. Something like 3 or 4 turns of wire all coming back to this tuning mechanism at the bottom of the Y. And I think you said each leg was 3 feet long. Therefore, there's something like 4.5 feet across the two tops of those legs. Is that approximately the way it looked, Glenn? Go ahead.
KC2MAR.
MAR recognized. Dick, I'll say one more time. 3 feet per side, so say 3 feet, 4 sides, and the square, or when I say triangle, I mean it was tipped up on its side, so it looked like a triangle instead of a square, just perspective. But it was 10 turns, through this thing with magnetic number 14 gauge wire, and it, how I did it was I took other smaller diameter, I think it was the half-inch PVC, and I just kept on, like, feeding the wire through, through this thing, and, through 4 3-foot length tubes, and just snaked it through the centers of it about 10 times, and then brought the two ends together at one end of the square, or the triangle, how you look at it, at the bottom, and that's where I put the vacuum variable, right across, so it was directly in parallel with the coil of wire, and then basically just put the coax in parallel with that. So, and then just tune the capacitance in parallel with the coax and the coil.
Okay, the person who just signed in was KB2, either Mike Alpha Romeo or November Alpha Romeo. Which is it? And go right ahead, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, KB2, Mike Alpha Romeo. Basically, a quick question. Isn't a quad antenna similar to the antenna you're talking about right now, except it's a much larger, like a full-length quad, full-size quad, comparing it to a loop that's also like a baseball diamond shape? Back to you.
Yeah, that's Gabe in Yonkers asking the question. And a cubical quad fed in the diamond manner comes relatively close, except that he's got 10 turns, not just one turn. Cubical quad normally has one turn. He's got 10 turns because he wants to tune it with this this vacuum variable capacitor, and he only wants to make 3 feet on the side. He's got a circumference of 12 feet. So for HF frequencies, it's kind of small. And did the coax cable go across the vacuum variable? How did you then do impedance matching, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it wasn't super scientific, Dick. Basically, the capacitor, the coils, or the loop of wire, and the coax were all directly in parallel. So when I tuned the capacitor, it was all in parallel with the coil and with the coax. And basically what I did was I kind of tried to center it around 10 megahertz or so, because 10 megahertz, it was like the middle of the short wave band. And so if I could tune to either side of that. So I know for sure it worked well into the 20s. I never tried it as high as 30 because I didn't really have anything of interest there to listen to. And I went as low as I know for sure. There was still some range below 5 megahertz. Because even at 5 megahertz, I could definitely peak up just by watching the S meter on the receiver. Because that's how I knew I was always in tune. Because I wasn't trying to match it with like a SW Warbridge, because it was just for a receiver. And when I was getting good high Q performance, I just watched the S meter, and you can actually see when you tune it, you'd see the background noise come up, you'd see that S meter move up, and you knew that you were in tune, and then just turn it for direction, and it's amazing what you could tune in.
If it went as low as 5 megacycles, my guess is you could tune it to WWV Boulder, Colorado, and my guess is that when the plane of your vertical loop, your loop was perpendicular to the ground, the plane of your loop is perpendicular to the ground, and when that plane included the direction to Boulder is when you got the greatest amount of signal from Boulder. So my guess is this thing didn't work, it didn't peak up the signal at right angles, it peaked up the signal in the plane of the loop when you're listening to a vertically polarized signal. Was that approximately true most of the time, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would definitely believe that to be so. And also, definitely I could tune in like all of the shortwave stations that put out like time, and you could always hear them either coming in from Canada or wherever else. All the foreign broadcast stations, you could hear them coming around the world. I mean, compared to a dipole, this thing would kick their pants. Just the availability also to get that broadside performance, to peak it up also, which was a nice thing to have. And it wasn't on a tower. It was basically mounted on a chimney mount at the time. And it had a very, very small, like a television rotator. And, basically the mast going up was all PVC. And this whole antenna was, pretty lightweight and pretty resistant to the wind. And really a good performer for shortwave. It's certainly nothing you'd want to transmit on, but as far as shortwave performance, it covered the shortwave bands beautifully.
That sounds like a fun antenna. And my guess is when you put the normal to that antenna toward the station, you would null out the station. Therefore, you could do precise direction finding if you wanted to. Sounds like a fun antenna. What made you stop using it when it works that well, Glenn? Go ahead.
I moved.
You got to build another one. That sounds like a winner. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this beautiful loop antenna? And that is primarily an H-field sensing antenna, in my opinion, in the way you described it. Anybody with any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2SYL with a question.
SYL, start off with your name, and I should know it. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question. Go ahead. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick. My name is Bill, Queens, New York. I just have a question about an antenna. I have some speaker wire that I bought at the dollar store. It's about 30 feet in length, and it's right next to one another, and it's encased. Can I use that to make a transmitting antenna for high frequency if I put the correct connectors on? What are the advantages and disadvantages of the parallel wire next to one another? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, speaker wire, some of them have clear plastic, and that clear plastic is slightly lossy at HF frequencies. I think it quite often acts like 70 ohm twin lead. And since a dipole antenna, if it was a half wavelength long, has an impedance of 70 ohms, that's a pretty good match. So properly fed speaker wire will make the transmission line, and then you split the ends of it, but if you've only got 30 feet of it, you don't have enough to make Well, let's see. You could make a dipole with that on 10 meters. The dipole in 10 meters would be 16 feet on a total length. So if you took 16 feet of your 30 away by splitting it, split 16 feet of it, you'd be, I said 16 feet. No, you don't have to split 8 feet. You split 8 feet of it. It'd be 8 feet to the right, 8 feet to the left on the dipole. You'd have 22 feet left over as a transmission line. So there's a dipole on the 10-meter band, 16-foot half-wave dipole. And if you're willing to sacrifice some of the transmission line length, you could also make a dipole on 15 meters and maybe 20. And there's nothing stopping you from buying more of that and extending your transmission line. Just simply solder the leads together. It wouldn't be much of a problem. So that will work. It's not perfect, but it could work quite well. Over to you, Bill, KQLIW in the TechNet.
All right, thanks. And if I put the correct connector on and attach it to a tuner, could I use it for the all the other bands on HF?
Yeah, now you're starting to push your luck. First of all, in the ideal world, you'd like to have some kind of a 50-ohm to 72-ohm balancing device at the transmission line. So this is the best of all worlds. Your coax cable coming out of the transmitter or out of the tuner is an unbalanced transmission line. This zip cord that you've just described is a balanced transmission line. If you didn't use any kind of a balun-like device, your transmission line is also going to be part of the antenna. It's not a showstopper, but it's just going to make things a little more complicated than you'd like. Is it going to work? Yes. If you put 100 watts into it, I think the loss of the plastic could give you some heating problems. It's not an ideal antenna, but I guarantee it's going to work. Now, is it going to be a gangbuster antenna? Probably not, but it's going to work. Let me see if Mel knows of anybody who has ever used that speaker wire as a transmission line, and how well did it work. Mel, have any of your crazy guys at the Kings County Radio Club done that? K2QIW, go ahead, Mel.
No, not speaker wire. Zip cord, yes. I've even used zip cord. Made it basically one time. I made up a dipole. In fact, I believe it was just for 10 meters. Just split it, made like a knot, you know, where I split it. So it wouldn't tear any further, wouldn't, you know, part any further. And it worked. And so I don't know about the plastic wire, but like, maybe it would behave just like a zip cord dick over.
Yeah, the brown zip cord is a kind of rubber material that's moderately lossy. The nice clear plastic that they've got on modern day speaker wire, and some of those speaker wires have got some real good gauge to them, like, you know, 12 and 14 gauge. I think it could work awfully well. So it's going to take a little bit of experimenting. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. You put a kilowatt into it, and I think it's going to run hot of the transmission line itself. In the ideal world, it would be nice to have some kind of a balancing device at the bottom. But will that make an antenna? Absolutely. And when you do build an antenna out of it, Bill, I'd like you to come back and tell us how well it worked. KC2SYL, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. It was inexpensive. It was only a couple of dollars in the dollar store, so I bought a roll of it. And I thought maybe I could use this. I better do my research first. And I'm looking in the antenna book. I didn't see any reference to it. But I did see the reference to the zip cord, so I understand that pretty well. And, Glenn, I think MFJ, maybe one vendor you're thinking of, and LDG is another vendor for the antenna tuners, especially the one that you described that has the capacitor in it. Those may be some places that you may want to look into, or maybe that drills your memory. Back to that. This is KC2SYL.
Glenn, do you recognize either of those brand names, and do you think any of those vacuum variables are still available? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
It's, I think it was called Arizona Surplus Supply. As a matter of fact, if you tune on, if you go onto the web and you do a Google for like automatic antenna tuners, and because you really want the match right on the antenna, you don't want to do it remote. And And I think it was called Arizona Surplus, but I'm not sure if that was exactly it or not. But I know if you do that Google for, you know, remote antenna tuners or electronic antenna tuners, they'll definitely come up, and you'll see the Surplus supply there. And they sell the vacuum variables up to, I mean, they sell, oh, remote antenna tuners that you can control from your shack, but the tuner's right at the antenna. Up to, I think, 10 kW. So, I mean, they got some pretty serious stuff there, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
DRF, Arizona Surplus Supply, if they still got that tuner, and I think you said it wasn't very expensive, got a rough guess as to how many dollars and what year did you buy it? Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, I ran across them, Dick, in about 91 or 92. It must have been around 92. Because I was down in Florida at the time, and I was looking for a good shortwave antenna, and I told you about my experience with running long wires near the beach over there. Not a great idea. This seemed like a better solution for something I'd want to bring a wire into the house with. And so I was much happier with that. And it's not a tuner. It's just a capacitor. It's a capacitor and a little motor assembly that came on a little piece. And I think about the time I paid like $12 or $15 plus some shipping. As a matter of fact, I'm on the web right now. I'm going to try to get the name of the supplier for you. But they sell everything there. And it was, this was just a vacuum variable capacitor. But it was so nice about it was that it came on a, like a little plate in a box that had the capacitor on it with the little motor drive and the control signal so that you could control the motor for, you know, for like up and down.
Yeah, that servo mechanism, I'm going to call it a tuner, but it's the basic remote tuning mechanism of a remote tuner. Beautiful. That sounds like a fun machine. That's a real servo. Similar to what you could operate a model airplane with. Radio control model airplane to move a control surface. Very well done. John, you haven't had a chance to talk yet tonight. KC2WGB. We've been holding you off for an awful long time. I wonder how things are going with that beautiful acquisition that you're about to get, HP 3561A, and I think you're also on the men.
QAQ with an update?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Surplus Sales of Nebraska is the name of the place, and it's just worth it just to go to their website and take a peek, KC2QIQ.
Sounds good. I'm going to have to look that one up. So, John, KC2WGB, have you possibly received your dynamic signal analyzer yet? Have you turned it on? And I think it's just a matter of time before you fall in love with that machine. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. I am on the mend, Dick. The operation went well, and no pain, but just got to wait for it to heal. The unit is in the calibration shop as we speak. I will have it in my possession Tuesday. So that's where I am with that. I have a few other items coming down, too. I've been buying an awful lot of stuff. But I do have one question on attenuators, Dick, if you can take that.
Yeah, my guess is your motivation for going to calibration is that you didn't necessarily need traceability to the Bureau. In other words, if your 3561 told you that the signal strength is 0 dBm, and it really was 2 dB away from that, I don't think that would bother you a great deal yet, and there's all kinds of other ways you could cross-check that. My guess is you went through calibration just to be double darn sure that everything is working is probably the reason you did that, and sounds like you got a very good deal on that one. So go right ahead with your further questions or comments, John, K2LIW.
No, it's intra-certified calibration right to the Bureau. They will be complete, and I will actually have it on my doorstep Tuesday. They told me. We'll see about that. My question on attenuators is this. I haven't received them yet, several attenuators, step attenuators, manual step attenuators. They're approximately 8 dB. I want to know if I can conveniently just series them to obtain. Will they still behave the same way, and can I count on them to work that way?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. If the step attenuator is properly designed so that internally it is a pi resistive network or a T resistive network, but most of them are pi,
which means that on each one of the steps between 0 and 8 dB, it still is a pure 50 ohm input impedance, a 50 ohm output impedance, and some selectable number of decibels of attenuation. If they fulfilled that requirement at your frequency range, every step attenuator ever built by mankind has a frequency range usually from DC to some frequency where the performance starts falling off. I mean, the Hewlett-Packard 355 C and D, I think they were, BNC input connector, and one of them goes from 0 to 11 dB, and one of them goes from 0 to 70 dB in 10 dB steps, one of them goes in 1 dB steps. They are rated, I believe, to 1,000 megacycles maximum. And many, many people, including me, let me drop, would set the 0 to 70 dB, 10 dB step attenuator first, cascaded with a BNC male-to-male connector into the one that went from 0 to 11 dB in 1 dB steps. And that way you had every 1 decibel step between 81 and 0 decibels, with maybe the whole assembly had at most of those frequencies half a dB or so of insertion loss, a constant offset, so to speak. So as long as your step attenuator has good 50 ohm input and output impedance at your frequency, you should be able to cascade as many of those as you like 10 of them if you wanted to. But now I will admit that if the input impedance at some of those steps starts deviating from 50 ohms, if you start getting, let me pick a number, a 3 to 1 or a 2 to 1 or 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio on the input when the output is properly terminated at some particular step, and with your instrumentation you can confirm this, if at your frequency you start seeing Vizwar effects, then when you start cascading them, depending on whether the length of cable between the attenuators is an odd number of quarter wavelengths or an even number of quarter wavelengths, you'll get some peculiar effects in one direction when it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths and the other direction when it's an even number of quarter wavelengths. You're starting to walk around the Smith chart with some peculiar effects between the attenuators, and it's all calibratable, but just that the steps that you select and the attenuation you get will start following some funny curves if they present some standing wave ratio. Over to you, John, KQLIW in the TechNet.
I was thinking of using double-ended SMA connectors, the little barrel connectors, to keep the cable loss and that type of thing down to a minimum. Would that be the proper way to do it?
There's a yes and a no to that one, John. By keeping the cable length between them, by using SMA barrels, as we call them, as short as possible, the total insertion loss is the least amount. Therefore, when you dial in zero on every one of them, you'll get as close to zero as you're going to get. That's the good news. If you start using high-quality cable between the step attenuators, and if at your favorite frequency, each one of those pieces of cable between the step attenuators is, let me pick a number, 1 decibel of loss. The advantage of putting loss between devices that have non-ideal standing wave ratio is that the overall standing wave ratio and peculiar effects starts becoming attenuated. If you could tolerate the extra insertion loss, and if you could put, let me pick a number, 6 decibel pads in between each step attenuator, even if your step attenuators had some pretty horrible standing wave ratio at your highest frequency, like 2 to 1 standing wave ratio, the ripple effect of the 2 to 1 standing wave ratio will start decreasing real fast as you put attenuation, whether it be distributed attenuation by a length of cable or a real fixed pad between them. If you can tolerate the extra insertion loss, then the Vizwar effects will start disappearing. So you've now got a compromise. Do you want the selectable dBs to be very predictable and the frequency response to be quite flat? You put attenuators. If you want the overall insertion loss when you dial minimum to be as low as possible, then you make everything short as possible. Somewhere between those two extremes is your ideal setting, depending on what you're trying to do. because gain these days and little bitty chip devices starts coming so inexpensively, you'd be amazed.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You'd be amazed how many people choose the padded effect. In other words, they put fixed attenuators between the step attenuators. Yes, they pick up some extra insertion loss, but they make it up with one of these little three-pin amplifier devices, and therefore the attenuation doesn't hurt them. And you can have your cake and eat it, too. Lots of ways of going about this. KC2, WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. That's very interesting. I will try that, and I will actually measure it and see which way is best for my experiments. And, oh, by the way, I do agree with Eric and the system that you want to initiate. I've always recommended, when I'm on anyway, that I'd like to go on after Mel, after he finishes, because that's important to get those young people off early. Then, thanks. I think this will work out fine. So let's see if anybody else has a question, and then if I have time, I'll ask you one more.
Yeah, I guess we can get the best happy medium by answering all the quick questions in the first hour, going over to Mel's mailbag, and then we'll dig into the deep stuff for the amount of remaining time, or the repeats on some of the first questions. So I guess I'll have people next week sign in, tell me when you sign in, is it what you believe is a quick question or a deep question? If it's a quick question, you go to the top of the priority list.
Let me clarify that for you.
Go right ahead, but I think it's a good suggestion overall of what you're suggesting. And yeah, we've been dragging it on with some pretty deep stuff in the beginning. Over to you, Eric.
Agree. It's a good way.
Here's the point, Dick. People come to this TechNet to ask their particular questions, okay? What you're talking with John and Wesley is a recurring theme, you know. It's not exactly the same, but you really go deep. And the reason why people come here is to answer the questions of the problems that they're dealing with right at that given time. You know, people come at 8 o'clock, it's a good time, get things going. You know, Mitch will ask a question, newcomers will ask a question, how do I put this antenna up, or how does this work, or that kind of thing. And you know right off the bat when you start talking to these people that you're not going to get into really heavy math or really extensive answers to a relatively simple question. And the people come, it's sort of like first come, first serve, so to speak, and it gives the other folks an opportunity to get in there. The guys that have the questions that want to be answered, they don't want to wait an hour for deep, actually it winds up being 2 hours before you even get to them. And if you listen to all the previous recordings, people who have checked in, by the time you get to them, they're gone. That's the issue.
Hey, you make a good point. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, Eric, I respect you very much, and I believe you are, among other guys, the person who is helping others. I have no problem if that's the suggestion that is going to bring more benefits to the net. I agree with that completely. I don't have a problem with that. My understanding is that I feel like Dick is kind of excited because there are a few people trying to talk about different subjects. Although, this TechNet is about every subject, space and cars and everything. So whatever the subject you feel like is the best, I'm going to agree with that and follow that. Dick, pick up.
Okay. With all those suggestions, next week we'll have this new procedure. All the faster questions answered during the first hour. And I'll have people volunteer ahead of time whether or not they think we've got a deeper or a light question. And so I'll make up two lists. One list for the first hour, and another list for the later hours where we get into the deeper questions. So that way we should have a larger number of happy people. Can't please everybody, but yes, I'm beginning to see the merit of this overall suggestion.
It's you, GG.
ahead, Gordon.
Hey, howdy. I've been listening intermittently throughout the evening, and you know, the real trick, Dick, is to resist the temptation to make a simple question, you know, a long-form answer. I know I have a tendency to do that. Sometimes on my net, I have to do that. And my son is agreeing with that. He's got a grin. He's sitting there. James is sitting there. Casey New SKV going, yeah. Anyway, so, but the truth is, so, sometimes on my tech net, I actually have to stretch it out because, you know, otherwise, sometimes we wouldn't have enough to talk about. Number two, I kind of got to get people fired up in order to contribute, other than, you know, you have mail on a cast of thousands. I kind of have to spark my cast of thousands to get engaged, so I'll kind of tweak them a little bit, and sometimes I'll even call them out directly if I know they're on the net. So, but that's the antithesis of what you're trying to do here. You want to keep simple questions simple with their answers, and, you know, if there's, after about three or four back and forth, you know, you're not getting as deep as you think you could, you know, deferred for the longer form later.
I see the merit of that, Gordon. One of the things I try to avoid, though, is giving an answer that is so brief that it creates ambiguity and it creates misunderstanding. There are a number of ham radio subjects where the amount of misunderstanding is huge. The insertion loss of a coax connector or adapter, the true effects of standing wave ratio, or whether or not the open wire line radiates when standing wave ratio is on it. You give the brief answer on that, and people will say, I don't believe you. I mean, I'm going to claim that open wire line, properly used with a balance, even though it's got huge standing wave ratio, does not radiate per se. Well, to really go through the explanation, that takes some time. Give the brief explanation, and a lot of people will go away with the wrong opinion. They've heard eight times in a row it does. From one time in a row from me, they've heard that it doesn't. It's going to take some more words. I guess I can stop after one brief explanation and tell them, there's a lot more to the story. You've only heard the beginning. And the later comes later. W2TTT for any other comments. K2RIW. Sound pretty good tonight.
I'm driving down Enoch here. That's exactly what you need to do. You need to make sure that they understand that there is more to the story and that you want to cover it, but for the sake of fairness on time for the early bird portion of the net, you kind of like, you're going to be something a little more engaging than a sniper, but yeah. I think you have the right attitude to this. You know, let them know that a partial answer or a succinct answer is not necessarily thorough enough to have a full understanding, and that you're going to take care of it in the second or third hour. Back to you. Thanks, Dick.
To S4YO with a comment, if I may.
Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dick, and to the rest of the net. I'm a relatively new ham, but I've had training in the physical sciences, and sometimes the questions I have are basic, but I try to do the research, and sometimes I can't come up with an answer that I can find easily. So that's why I asked my question about the antenna tonight. And I do appreciate the metaphysical discussions that we have about free energy and so on, and I understand that because, once again, I had training in the physical sciences. But I think that gets a little too deep, and it's fine for a conversation, but if you're trying to reach the broader audience, which I know you are, because you actually have a worldwide audience, some of the questions I would think that the basic questions that new hams would like to answer, not only young ones, but newer ones like myself. And then I also appreciate the questions about space and about antennas and the difference between radiation and electromagnetic waves and the ionosphere and how the waves turned and all that. I find that very interesting. So I think you have to find a balance, and I know probably one Several individuals are interested in the metaphysical aspects, but I think that you can have that, but maybe later on, because not everyone can stay up until 1 o'clock in the morning. It's my comment. This is Bill. Name is call sign is KC2SYO.
Very fine, Bill. Whitestone, New York. I'm trying to remember who else lives in Whitestone. N2EO, I think, lives in Whitestone.